And in all my best imagination, I could never imagine the number of mail pieces that I received, email pieces, phone calls, everything that you could possibly think of. I never could really get the point until somebody said, and then a lot of them followed, "Since I was a little kid, you have been a sound of summer." So that gave me kind of an idea about what this day was all about. I have received so many, I could never, ever say thank you to all of the people who sent them. So at this time, I hope that the word gets out to one and all. I say from the bottom of my heart, thank you and God bless you to everybody. To everybody.
There from day one, he was the voice of summer for so many of us. In this special edition of the Canadian Baseball Network podcast, we pay tribute to Tom Cheek.
I was 8 years old, my birthday present, a baseball glove, and my first J's fitted. I felt like Robbie, my fingers to the sky, I could still hear the call.
I'm swinging, there's a drive.
Big league dreams for a kid to cherish. One team, one color, ride a country together, I'll never forget it.
Winfield, what's nice?
You feeling blue could bring so much joy. Devo on patrol, looking like Willie Mays. Bob Davis and Blewett, we knew it's a triple play. Guzman and Jerry Curl, crew with a mullet. Bring the Terminator in, as soon we knew it was over. The flashback memories, they making me smile. Tom Cheek painting pictures through your radio dial.
There's a bunny ball. Templin to Carter, and the Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays, the Blue Jays are World Series champions.
Close my eyes and I can see it. Give you something to believe in. Dreaming. The first time I heard it myself, I'll never forget that.
Hello, my name is Peter Bean. Thank you for joining me for the Canadian Baseball Network's tribute to Tom Cheek. For this tribute, we've assembled some of Tom's closest friends and colleagues to share their favorite stories and moments from the time they spent with him. Our guests include Jerry Howarth, Buck Martinez, Mike Wilner, and Bob Elliott. In this episode, I'm pleased to be joined by both Jerry Howarth and Bob Elliott. In part two, I'll speak with Mike Wilner and Buck Martinez. Before we speak to Jerry and Bob, I'd like to tell you about the song that opened the show today. The song is called A Swing and a Belt, and is a tribute to Tom Cheek by Saskatoon hip-hop artist Rational. At the end of this episode, I'll tell you where you can download the track for free, and we'll close the show by playing out the full song. Now let's listen to my conversation with Jerry Howarth and Bob Elliott about their close friend and colleague, Tom Cheek.
All right, I want to thank you guys both for being here. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show to talk about Tom. I want to start with you, Jerry, if I can, and ask you when you first met Tom Cheek.
I first met Tom back July 4th, 1980. I was in Salt Lake City, and they asked me to come to Tiger Stadium because Tom's partner, Early Wynn, was going to participate in an old-timers game at Dodger Stadium that weekend, and they said, "Would you fill in for him?" And I said, "I'd be happy to." So I arrived at Tiger Stadium, and the first person I met was Tom, and he said, "Hello, welcome to the broadcast." He handed me a tape recorder, and he said, "I want you to go and do the pregame show. You interview anybody you want." And I said, "Thank you, Tom, I'll do that." I went right down to the Blue Jays clubhouse because in my 5 years in the Pacific Coast League, I had gotten to know Roy Howell, who was with Spokane, the Texas Rangers AAA club. He was my first ever interview on a Blue Jays broadcast, and I'll never forget it.
All right, Bob, what about you? When did you meet Tom?
I met Thomas in 85. I would say it was in, I think it was in Baltimore. It was on the road somewhere. I was covering the Expos, and I was on the road, and they said, "You're covering the wrong horse. Get off the Expos." And I was with the Blue Jays the final 6 weeks of the 85 season, but I really didn't get to know him, I would say, till 87, flying the charters, I guess.
Jerry, do you remember the first game that you called with Tom?
Well, I do. It was that weekend, of course, in 1980, and Early and I and Tom called the first game on Friday night. And I remember how gracious Tom was. He said, "Jerry, you come in whenever you want." And I did do that, and I called four innings. And then on Saturday, and the adrenaline was flowing pretty good, too. It was my first Major League game, even though I'd done AAA baseball for 5 years in the Coast League. But on Saturday, that's when Early left. So Tom and I broadcast both games by ourselves Saturday and Sunday, and I did 3, 4, 7, and 8, which is what I did all those years after that. But I remember then how much more comfortable I was, and by Sunday, I was just right where I was calling those games for 5 years in the Coast League. And in great part, that was because of Tom. Tom made me relax, and he said, just be yourself, come in whenever you want. When you get that kind of freedom from an old pro, and Tom was the old pro at that time, I was just a rookie, it really helped me to relax.
How are you and Tom similar as broadcasters?
Well, I'd have to say in many ways we weren't similar. We were pretty much opposites on and off the mic, and I've always told people over the years, I really believe the best teams on radio are the most opposite. Tom and I had different voices. We had different ways of preparing for the game. We had a different approach regarding on-air in our presentation. I was probably more a student of the game, more clinical. I enjoyed mixing with players, umpires, managers, and coaches to learn the game and try to pass that on to the fans. And I think for Tom, he was a sophisticated fan who loved to see the Blue Jays win, wasn't too happy when they didn't win, but he had that big baritone voice, and he loved calling the games. That's one thing we did share in common. We had a passion for baseball. We loved the game, and we happened to be the Blue Jays broadcasters, and you knew that from the tone of our voice.
How did you make it work so seamlessly, night after night after night? I mean, you worked together for so long.
We did, and remember, it was fun for both of us because when I was first introduced at the press conference to begin the 82 season, when I took over full-time for Early, somebody brought up, hey, you guys are Tom and Jerry. Look at Big Tom right there. He's a big cat, and look at little Jerry. He's kind of like Jerry the Mouse right there, and everybody started to laugh, and so did we. And I think the bottom line for us, though, Peter, was we were professional. And to this day, too, it's my goal to bring the game to the fans, not too many distractions. I've been blessed with great partners after Tom left. But for the precedent that we set, Tom and I talked about the game. We didn't deviate from it. We had a lot of interesting stories, anecdotes. We played off each other a little bit. But it was more what's happening on the field. That's what the fans want. And we had that professionalism where we put it together. And we also realized that neither of us had played the game. So we didn't go out on branches and indicate to one and all that we knew more than we did. No, we didn't. We just respected the game. We called it the way it was. We were constructively critical. And at the same time, when the Blue Jays did well, that came out in our voices, too. And because we both shared that same professionalism, it made for a great team.
Jerry, I was just wondering, we all know how hard writers work, but a writer from one of the four Toronto papers will go on a road trip for 10 days, like you guys are on right now, and he'll come home, and he'll get the first two or three days off. You guys, boom, you're back at the park at 2 o'clock the next day. I mean, how difficult a grind is it year after year for you two guys?
Well, I always felt myself, Bob, that it wasn't a grind from this standpoint. And I tell young sportscasters the same thing who approach me and ask me to review their work, because I was that young sportscaster years ago. I tell them part of my homework is getting my rest. I get my 7.5, 8 hours a night. If I can't, I make sure that that's not repeated more than a day or two. And since I was at the University of Santa Clara, where I studied hard, made the most of my academic life, I've always been able to take a 25-minute nap. I've done that since I was about 20, 21 years old. And I think for me, I always tell people, I kid them, that even though I get up early, by the time I take that nap around 1 o'clock from 1 to 1:20, 1:25, I get 2 days for every one day that everybody else gets, because the nap allows me to refresh myself, go out to the ballpark, and it's a new day. And I've already done my homework at the laptop computer, or before that in public libraries where you're finding newspapers for 30 days to cull information that you want to share with the audience. And then when I go on the air with Hello Friends, it should be upbeat. It should be refreshed. It should be like I'm just coming off a pretty good night's sleep and a nap. And that's what I take great pride in, that's part of my homework, to make sure I sound that way for the audience.
So you would, this afternoon nap that you're talking about, you would only do that before night games. Is that right?
That's right, because for a night game, you can do that. Now, when you have a day game after a night game, then you make sure that you try to get your rest in a different way. And for me, to give you an example with this trip here in Anaheim, when I got back to the room after the night game before today's game in Oakland, well, I made sure when I went to bed 12:30, I got up at 7:30. Well, that's 7 hours. That's pretty good. Normally, I get 7.5. I'm very comfortable with that, sometimes 8. But if I get 7, I'm in pretty good shape, don't need a nap. And now tomorrow there's a night game here in Anaheim, so I'll get up early again and take that nap as I do for most of the night games. And then if you get cut short where, let's say it's an extra inning game and you can't get to bed till 1 or 1:30 and you get up at 7:30 and you have 6 hours of sleep, that's okay for a night, maybe two at the most. But I've never gone too much beyond that because when I get tired, what gets tired? My voice. And I don't want that to happen because that's my instrument and I have to use it properly, and sleep and rest allows me to do that.
Can either of you recollect, I've been thinking about this a lot, been doing my research about Tom and his streak. Can either of you recollect when it was first recognized and when people started talking about it as a streak?
Well, I'll start first on that. Tom, I think probably when the streak got to about the point where it was about 20 years old, people started to talk about, Tom, have you ever missed a game? And he said no, and I think then it probably came to the attention, wow, that's pretty good. How many games would that be? And Bob is a very good researcher. He does a lot of that work, and it might have even been someone like Bob who started to count the games and put them together. I will say this about the streak. I've said this as well. Tom missed a lot of his kids' graduations from high school to college to even his daughter Lisa's graduation from a business school, which Tom later regretted. He told me, you know, I wish I had gone to my daughter's graduation. What am I thinking? And I remember even down here in Southern California, we were playing the Angels, and his mother was about a week away from passing away in, I believe, New Orleans. And Tom actually left the radio booth that night, and the next day he was at the airport ready to be at her bedside, and he came back. And he came back because he just wanted to broadcast again, and whether it was for keeping the streak or not, he was always someone who wanted the fans to know he was there, blue-collar worker, and I think that was probably more important to him than the streak itself. But those were the sacrifices and missed opportunities he had to keep that moving, and it did eventually get to the point where in Oakland, when his father passed away, that's when it ended, as he went to see his father's wife, Marie, and she was in Monterey when his dad at 86 passed away. He'd taken a shower and died of a heart attack, and that's when that ended.
I don't have any, I can't take any credit for this, compiling this streak or anything. The only thing I would share is that, the only thing I would share is John Miller, when I spoke to him, he said that how he kind of envied guys like Dave Van Horn and Dave Niehaus and Tom. You saw the first pitch and you were a walking, living, breathing history of the franchise. You saw from he said that was the interesting part. The downside was everyone expected you to remember every pitch.
Jerry, I want to talk about October 24th, 1992. You hand the mic to Tom for what was supposed to be your inning to call. When did you make that decision?
Well, the way it worked out, I did 7 and 8, and then Tom did 9, and because a lot of games ended even after 8.5 innings, we always felt that he should do the 10th inning to have at least a couple of innings back-to-back. So after that, it was every other inning. So the game went to the 11th inning in Atlanta, and it was tied at 2, and so that was my inning. So I didn't think too much about it. And Dave Winfield comes up with 2 on and 2 outs, and Charlie Liebrandt 3-2 changeup, and Dave reaches out and yanks it over third past Terry Pendleton. The ball goes down the line, and Devo and Roberto Alomar both score, and now it's 4-2, and the inning ends. So I'm saying to myself, you know, Tom was here for day one. This is his baby. I'd like to be here a long time, too. But to do the right thing, and Tom doesn't have any idea that this is going to happen, I think he should call the first World Series winner. And it's only because my inning happened to come up that I'm here, but Tom should do it. So at the end of the half inning, we started the bottom of the 11th inning, and I remember I just looked straight ahead and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I've had the pleasure of calling Dave Winfield's 2-run double. The Blue Jays lead 4-2, but now here's Tom to take you the rest of the way. It completely took him by surprise. He sat up. He was so happy. He took the mic, called the bottom of the inning, and the Blue Jays won it, and it was the best thing for me because I got more pleasure and satisfaction out of Tom calling it than had I called it.
After that game, any good stories from that night after the first win? I imagine you guys had a pretty great celebration.
Well, for me, people ask me, what's the highlight of your career? And I tell them two of them. With my two boys and my wife in the clubhouses in Atlanta after that game, and the next year in Toronto after Joe Carter's home run against Philadelphia. Now, what was nice for me with my two boys, they were 14 and 16 at the time. My wife was in the clubhouse, and she was off to the side with the other wives and girlfriends of the players. But with me, as I went to every player and gave them a hug and told that player why I thought they contributed, why that player contributed to the World Series championship, I had Ben on my right shoulder, Joe on my left shoulder. They were just in awe. They took it all in. They were with their pop as he went through that entire clubhouse. And those are the two best memories I have of my Major League career, those father-son nights in those two clubhouses. And then in Atlanta, which made it even more special, after everything kind of calmed down and still the clubhouse is a zoo, my two boys came up to me, and they knew I knew Wayne Gretzky from my time in Toronto. And they said, Dad, did you know that Wayne's here? I said, no, he's with the Kings. They said, no, he's over in the corner. And I look over, and Wayne comes over to me, and I said, Wayne, look at you. What are you doing here? He said, Jerry, I wanted to be here for Canada's World Series championship. And if he had been hurt, somebody had taken a shot at him up against the boards, and he hurt his back. And I said to him, how's your back? And he kind of rolled his eyes and looked to the ceiling. He said, well, it's better. It's not where I want it to be, but it's getting better. And that was a memory I'll always have, too. Wayne Gretzky, more than just a hockey player, a Canadian who wanted to be there and was for the Blue Jays World Series championship, and I really respected that.
Tom's iconic call in 93. Did either of you recognize how important that call was and what it would become that night?
Well, I've done a lot of the talking here. Let's start with Bob.
Well, I didn't hear it. I mean, you know, being at the park. I should tell you about Game 6. Jerry told the great story there about his two boys. I bought tickets for the strip of tickets for the postseason games, and my wife told my son, you can't go to Game 6, you can go to Game 7. So he probably heard Tom and Jerry before because they always watched on the TV and listened to the radio. He probably heard the call hours before I did. I don't think we were able to get out of there until about there was a post-game reception. But I know guys trying to make the Philly guys trying to make their flight back at 6 a.m. had trouble because of the traffic downtown. Nobody said, well, this is a hockey town on that morning. But as for its lasting strength, I didn't know it would have that. I mean, I think what we anticipated. Oh well, they're going to go for three in a row. There'll be memories next October, and you know we haven't had a postseason game since.
And for me, my own personal memories about that were, number one, I was sitting down in the dugout because at that time I did the post-game interviews live from the dugout. I did 7 and 8, and then Tom would call 9. So after the 8th inning, I would go down in the dugout. So I remember a couple things in particular. One, on the 2-1 pitch, Joe swung badly at it and missed. Now the count's 2-2, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, who am I going to interview with the Phillies here about Game 7 tomorrow night, Pat Henkin pitching against the Phils? And then whack, he hits one down the left field line. I kind of leaned forward in the camera bay, and I looked at Joe. Now, I wasn't sure if the ball was going to go fair or foul, but Joe, when I looked at him, he's going down to first base, and he's jumping up and down. He knows, and I can see that, and I watch him at first base. He's jumping all around. He comes all the way around third, and now there's a sea of players celebrating with him at home plate. I hadn't heard the call. I didn't know what the call was. Well, as it turned out, Tom, and for me, now, on a call like that, I would have simply said, if there's a home run, the Blue Jays win the World Series, and I would let the crowd come in for about a minute. But Tom had that big voice. He had that big baritone voice. So he kept talking and went right over the crowd because he could do it with his voice. But what made the call iconic was as he's finishing, he looks down at Joe, and he sees Joe jumping up and down around first base, and then very spontaneously, you can't manufacture these things, he says, touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life. That's what made it with Joe jumping up and down around the bases. And then to add to that, my wife Mary is sitting with his mother, and his mother sees this, and she looks at my wife and says, my son the kangaroo. And I thought it was the line of the World Series.
Now, Jerry, you also have another good one about, was it Mrs. Henkin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me tell you about that. So now Joe Carter hits the home run, and there's a celebration at home plate. And I want to pause right here before I talk about Pat Henkin's parents, because this is only the second time at that point, and still the only second time, that a game of a World Series ended, where the World Series ended on a walk-off home run. Bill Mazeroski did it in 1960, and then 33 years later, Joe Carter did it in Toronto. Now, that's the only time it's happened in World Series history. Well, when Bill Mazeroski hit home plate, his shortstop for the Pittsburgh Pirates, Dick Schofield, was right there in that celebration, pounding Mazeroski on the back. Great thrill and a tremendous moment as the Pirates beat the New York Yankees. 33 years later, as Joe Carter hits home plate, Dick Schofield Jr., the Blue Jays shortstop who had broken his arm in May and was replaced by Tony Fernandez, he is pounding Joe on the back. He's in the celebration. What are the odds that the only two times a World Series ended with a walk-off home run, a father and son would be there for both games? That's why I love baseball. Those are the kind of moments that make me love baseball and the passion that I have for it. So that was pretty special in and of its own right for Joe to go around the bases and do that. Well, unbeknownst to me, and I found this out later, Pat Henkin's mom, Marcia, she could not watch these moments. In fact, she could never watch her son pitch, Pat, even in spring training. She's just too nervous. And I got to know Pat and Marcia Henkin very well. Pat's dad is named Pat as well. Well, so Joe hits the home run, and on the concourse there behind the 100-level seats, Marcia's walking along, and all of a sudden the home run is hit, and she turns around. There's a gentleman right there, and he looks at her, and she looks at him, and they hug each other, and they're so happy. And Marcia pulls back, and then the gentleman says, "You look so happy." And she says, "Yes, my son is Pat Henkin. He was going to have to pitch Game 7. Now he doesn't have to." And he says, "My name is Bud Molitor. My son Paul was on the base paths. I couldn't watch either." And that was the first time those two had ever met.
What about in the booth, what are some of your favorite moments that you and Tom had other than the World Series?
And that's a good question. We had moments. We had a lot of professional moments where I think we really enjoyed each other's calls, each other's enjoyment of the Blue Jays winning. And remember, they have not won for 20 years. They haven't been to the playoffs for 20 years. Tom and I came along right at a time where the team started to gel. I always tell people, I kid them, I say in 1982, everybody thinks Bobby Cox, who came along that same year, turned the Blue Jays around. Well, my mom thinks I did it. And I don't tell her any different. She's 90 years old. She still thinks Jerry Howarth went to Toronto, and he created this environment to win and go to the playoffs. But really, it gets back to Tom and I enjoyed 1982 and the emergence of Bobby Cox, who put a stamp of approval on this team and began to move it forward in the right way. Now, instead of the sizzle, it was the steak. And I happened to come along at that time, and then in 85, the Blue Jays won their 99 games. They started to move forward from that. But there were a lot of opportunities where Tom and I enjoyed each other's company. I began to watch him from a distance. He was so good at hosting Labatt Blue lunches. He was so good with the affiliate stations. He was so good in the winter going from coast to coast. And I admired that. I didn't do a lot of that myself, but I saw how he did it, how hard he worked, how much he enjoyed the people, how much he talked with the people. And those were the moments that I shared as a broadcaster with him, too, and I was so happy for him to do it. And the saddest moment for me came when he couldn't do those games anymore because of his brain cancer, because he stopped doing what he loved to do.
Which was his favorite outside of the World Series? Did he have a favorite game, a favorite moment other than the two wins?
I don't think so. I don't think even for me, my sons in those clubhouses, those were special moments for me, and Dave Winfield's call was special. I think for Tom, it really was that blue-collar approach where it was every game. Those 4,306 games, they each had a different moment. I think Tom could probably tell you, too, about a double play that the Blue Jays hit into that they lost a game and how big and how important it was. And that was Tom. He was the sophisticated fan where everybody wanted to be. Tom couldn't, so they just sat back and enjoyed him calling the games. And I did, too. So I don't think it was ever any special moments per se. I just think that we went through 162 games year after year after year. And that's what makes us special, because it's twice as many games as the other sports when you talk about hockey and basketball. And it just gives you an opportunity to be consistent, to be steady and to inform and entertain the audience, and we did that. I think probably the best answer is because we didn't have those. We didn't have great highs and great lows, and that's what you want from your audience.
Bob, do you know much about how Tom was with the players, the coaches?
Tom liked the golf, and so if he liked the golf, you were in his foursome, whether it be Cito or Jeff Ross. Not that I golfed, but I used to hear the stories about trick shot artist Tommy Craig hitting a ball off his tee between his legs, which was quite unintentional. But whereas Tom would, Tom was very, very close with Buck Martinez. I would say Jerry was like in the days of flying the charters. I mean, you'd see Jerry talking to Mike Flanagan and Tom Hankey's group or John Cerruti's group or whomever, whereas Tom would sit and read and, you know, or maybe talk with some of the coaches. And he was that was his downtime when we were on the charters, you know. But whereas Jerry was like the Energizer bouncing around the planes.
Jerry.
Continually working.
Sorry. Shirley said in her speech that everyone has a Tom Cheek golf story. Do you have one, Jerry?
Well, what I remember, in a different sort of way, oftentimes Tom would come to the ballpark and I would arrive maybe a little bit after him, or I would arrive and go back and redo the route that he had started from the parking lot. And everybody would tell me, oh, I'm sorry to hear about Tom. And I would say, why? And they would say, oh, he's got a bad back today. And, okay, that happened a lot. Well, now the exception was one day I'm walking around the Rogers Center, then the Sky Dome, and I hear, boy, Tom is so happy today. And I said, why? I said, well, I don't know. He's just so happy. He's talking about being on the golf course. And so finally I get to the radio booth, and Tom, how you doing? He says, oh, I'm doing so well. I'm so happy. And I said, why? And he looked at me and he said, because I got into Cito's wallet today. I made a putt on 18. And so that really stood out, because oftentimes Tom was complaining about something, but here he was so happy to talk about winning $20 off Cito Gaston.
One time we were sitting there in the lunchroom at Dunedin when it was on the third base line, and I was sitting with Buck. And it's like, I don't know, half an hour to game time. I don't even know if you guys were doing the game that day, but in walks Tom, and his face is beet red, and he's got on one of those silly golf hats that the silly golfers wear. And he goes over, gets his food, he comes back, slams the plate down, doesn't say hello to Buck, doesn't say hello to me, driving the food into him, and Buck kicks me under the table, and he says, so, Tom, did you golf today? And the steam is coming out of his ears, you know. Like, I never understood the game of golf, because it can make you so angry. Like baseball, it can break your heart, but you wake up wanting to go and unbreak your heart the next day.
Well, that is so true, and I played a lot of golf. I grew up on a golf course. I caddied in U.S. Open when I was 20, so golf was a part of me. But by the time I got to Toronto and started to broadcast, I decided to put it aside. It took too much time, and my back was an issue at that time, too. But I knew that Tom was a recreational golfer, and he had fun trying to break 100, and that was good. There's a certain amount of fun you can have, too, just trying to do that. And so Tom, for him, that was a good outlet, to get out on the golf course and have fun doing it. And I was glad he had that outlet so he could enjoy that part of his career.
Another thing that Shirley told me when I spoke with her, that he was a bit of a prankster at home, that the whole family was. I imagine that wasn't strictly at home. Do you guys remember any good ones that he either pulled on you or you got on him?
Well, I have to say, for me, being a prankster at home, I never saw Tom at home. I never saw that in the radio booth. So for me, that was two different people. I think Tom was two different people. I think actually he was far more relaxed and kind of giving back and forth and give and take, especially in the off season, than he was during the season, where I think sometimes he might have been consumed a little bit by the role that he had and who he was and the number one guy in the booth. And so I didn't see that lightness. I didn't see that pranksterism there, but I'm sure it was there because in the wintertime when I saw pictures and heard about Tom's winter with his kids and grandkids, I thought, wow, that's pretty good. I'm glad he can be that happy and enjoy that. So I think, too, sometimes our off-seasons are a little bit different than our seasons.
I didn't see the prankster, but I saw a sense of humor, and it was, it could be, he would do the first two innings, and then he'd come in and he'd say something like, go for a bag of popcorn. He says, you guys got the same score in here as we do. That one never failed to get a chuckle out of people. And then he said, we were in Kansas City one day, and he said, well, I played that Deer Creek golf course today, and I now know why they call it Deer Creek. So Alan Ryan from the Star turned around and he said, oh, did you see a lot of deer, Tom? And he said, no, my ball was in a creek all day. And he stomped off angry, like as if Alan had provoked him.
One funny story I can tell you about Tom at Old Exhibition Stadium. It was a night game. As you know, many seagulls were around that ballpark. And we had the big window open at nighttime, probably about the maybe if it might have been the ninth inning. If it wasn't the ninth inning, it was about the sixth inning because I did 3, 4, 7, and 8. So Tom is calling the game, and all of a sudden you kind of hear, well, here's the pitch, ball one. Whoa, what's this? And he looks down, and a seagull had swept by and just pooped right on his scorebook. So there it is. It's kind of yellow and runny. It's right on his book, and he's in the middle of his play-by-play, and he kind of lifts the page, and he goes, ew, look at this. And I looked, and it was awful, a big blob of seagull poop right there in his book. So he got through the inning. He was kind of laughing a little bit, too, and thinking, what happened here? And then he kind of had to separate those pages, and I think the broadcast lost a little of its flavor, if you will, from that point on.
I want to ask you how Tom would feel about all this attention being centered around him and all the awards that he's been given recently. How do you think he would feel about all of this?
Well, personally, I think over the years, people have asked me, do you think that Tom was overlooked? And I said, no. I wasn't one who thought it's about time Tom won the Ford Frick Award. No, I looked at it just the opposite, and I think this is exactly how Tom would have looked at it, too. Look at the august company he is in, and look at the people who preceded him the last 8 years. They were icons in their cities before Tom, and they worked many, many years before Tom, and they were the Tom Cheeks of their time and in their cities and even nationally. So Tom right now, I think, would tell you, I'm so happy that there was an opportunity for me to be on that list of 10 and look at the people who preceded me, and now it's my turn. I'm very happy with that. And I think he would be very modest and very unassuming, saying, no, my time was now, and I'm really happy to be a part of it. And I'd never gone in. That would have been okay, too, because I love my work. I love what I did. But it was not about awards. And I thought Tom was very modest and unassuming that way.
My last question for you both. I'd like to ask you what the one specific thing you think about Tom that made the fans fall in love with him so much.
Well, for me to start on that, I would say consistency. And I think the streak probably served its purpose that way too. And it reflects Tom's attitude was this. It wasn't about Tom. It was, I'm here for the fans. I've got this job. And I owe it to the fans every day to come and give my best, whatever that is. And he did that for 27 and a half years. And I'll always marvel at that because he put everything else second to not Tom Cheek, but for Tom Cheek broadcasting across Canada, those Blue Jays games for one and all. And I really respected him for that.
I would say maybe the booming voice, and also the thing about him was that He had a as you do, Jerry, the air of professionalism that you know, like we sometimes as writers, we sometimes get flustered or whatever, like by, you know, like, but Tom, I remember the year they signed Molitor and I went on two days of the caravan. I think it was Kitchener, it was Waterloo, about four stops, it was Cambridge, it was London or whatever. And they would go to questions in the crowd. And if I heard once, and poor Paul Molitor, if he heard it once, he must have heard it 25 times. How do you expect to replace Dave Winfield? Well, he was 5 years younger. He did everything better except hit home runs. And I mean, Tom, like, instead of, like, you know, Tom said, well, there's a new one you haven't heard, Paul. You know, this would be the first one at a new site, of course. And everybody in the tour would kind of chuckle, and Molitor would answer it graciously. And eventually, I don't know, about 6 weeks into the season, everybody understood why they decided to go with Molitor over paying Winfield a three-year, multi-year contract. I mean, he didn't look at anybody and say, geez, that's a dopey question. I admired that.
Yeah, I really did too. That's where Tom didn't bat an eye. He didn't get down into negativity or whatever. He just went with the flow, Bob, and I think that's very well said too. That, again, it wasn't about Tom, and that was a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to come on and talk about Tom. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure that our listeners are going to love hearing about these stories. So thank you both so much.
You are welcome.
Thank you much.
And with that, we'll bring today's episode to a close. I'd like to thank Jerry Howarth and Bob Elliott for taking the time to join me to discuss their memories of Tom. And I'd also like to thank Rational for allowing us to use the track in this tribute. You can get the track for yourself at rational.bandcamp.com, and as I mentioned earlier, we'll post the link on our podcast page for you as well. As always, a special thanks goes to Effective Business Video for the production for our show as well. Join us for our next episode in the Tom Cheek Tribute, where we'll speak to Buck Martinez and Mike Wilner. Look for that episode soon. Thanks for listening to the Canadian Baseball Network podcast. This is Peter Bean, signing off.
I was 8 years old, my birthday present, a baseball glove, and my first chase fitted. I felt like Robbie, my fingers to the sky, I could still hear the call.
I'm swinging, there's a drive.
Big league dreams for a kid to cherish. One team, one color, ride a country together, I'll never forget it.
Winfield was nice.
Who knew feeling blue could bring so much joy? Devo on patrol, looking like Willie Mays, Bob Davis and Blewett. We knew it's a triple play. Guzman and Jerry Curl, crew with a mullet. Bring the Terminator in, and soon we knew it was over. The flashback memories, they making me smile. Tom Cheek painting pictures through your radio dial.
There's a bunny ball. Timlin to Carter, and the Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays are World Series champions.
Close my eyes and I can see it. Give you something to believe in. Dreaming. The first time I heard it myself, I'll never forget that.
Swinging a belt.
The start of 93, echoed through all of Canada. Put the banner up, defending World Series champions. Fantasy roster, seven all-stars. I swear this team was sent from the heavens above. Second to none, Dad and I, we watched it all. Those bats on fire like a beast in cigar. Wham, coded acronym, everyone I don't know. White Alamo, Molitor, Carter, and Johnny O. 400 flirting hotter than a smoked out souffle. Even Americans singing, okay, Blue Jays. Who could forget about Tony and Ricky? Cito had the team buzzing through the whole town. City, stand on Mr. Gillick, he never was standing pat. Borders framing borderline pitches behind the mask. Remember while those two trophies sit on the shelf. Rest in peace, rest Tom Cheek.
Swing and a belt, a field, way back. Blue Jays win it. The Blue Jays are World Series champions. As Joe Turner hits a three-run home run in the ninth inning, and the Blue Jays have repeated as World Series champions. Touch them all, Joe. You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Close my eyes and I can see it. Give you something to believe in. Got a whole country dreaming. The first time I heard it myself, I'll never forget that.
Swing and a belt.
The dawn of a brand new day at the home of number one Blue Jays way. I love this team. Keep believing till our dreams come true. 30 million plus strong and we bleed blood blue. We stuck through it and we still holding on. The memories sustain us even though you're gone. 28 years with a mic in his hand. 1430 and 590 to fan. The times we had, he spoke and brought them to life. Sky Dome, 50,000 every single night. Now each spring hopes to tunnel through the summer and fall together just like Joe. We'll be touching them all. I can still hear the roar. What a joyous thunder. Baritone in my stereo. That voice of summer playing in my loudspeaker. heavens got an angel in the outfield.
Tom Cheek.
He was the voice of summer.
Nearly 28 straight years.
From April 7th, 1977 to June 2nd, 2004.
4,306
regular season games.
Tom Cheek.
The late Tom Cheek is a legend.
Cheek will soon take his place in the Hall of Fame.
Tom Cheek is off the Cooperstown.
Say from the bottom of my heart, thank you and God bless you. To everybody.